Up and down the country, bands were beginning to form. Iron Maiden in London, Def Leppard in Sheffield, Saxon in Barnsley. The Midlands saw a number of bands coming to prominence, the most influential being Diamond Head. North of the border, Holocaust and Heavy Petting would fly the flag, and this new movement, dubbed the New Wave of British Heavy Metal, was a peculiarly British affair. Although, unlike other subgenre, it was a national rather than local explosion of music, and it was driven by what was almost a grassroots collective. As bands took their lead from punk, which means anybody can do it, give it a try and see what you've got, and instead of waiting for record companies to take notice, they financed and recorded their very own releases. The name came from a feature written by Jeff Barton in Sounds newspaper. Once Barton turned in his review on a three-band bill featuring Angel Witch, Iron Maiden and Samson at London's Music Machine on the 9th of May 1979, and the paper's editor, Alan Lewis, added the byline, "The New Wave of British Heavy Metal." Now, unlike other genres or trends, though, it soon became apparent that this new wave was no mere fad. It was a nationwide phenomenon. John Gallagher of Raven explains.
It wasn't a club. All over England, there was a lot of kids who didn't like punk and they liked heavy metal and they wanted to play it. And all of a sudden, they all bloomed at the same time. And they were all totally different. The only thing they had in common was the passion and the energy, which made it great. And that doesn't happen too often. And all these bands organically came out with a similar kind of attitude, but not really sounding the same.
As bands started to spring up on Tyneside, a small independent record label by the name of Neat Records, albeit somewhat by chance, began to sit up and take notice. Situated in the heart of industrial Tyneside, in a run-down old theatre at 71 High Street East Wall's End, lay Impulse Studios, a recording studio owned by local entrepreneur David Wood. Impulse was a modest operation, and it lacked any of the glamour that you might expect with a recording studio to have. Steve Thompson was an in-house producer at Impulse, and he produced the first wave of the new wave of British heavy metal acts.
Receptionist, a tape-op, me, Mickey Sweeney and Dave Wood. It was just a very small bunch of people. But we had a string of tape-ops. There was one young lad who was a little bit abrasive and often used to say the wrong things. And we were in the midst of a session, and this young tape-op was on an ET, employment training, during the Thatcher years. We called it extra tenor, because they got an extra tenor. When the band came through for a playback, I said to the bass player, he says, "Oh, sell your bass and have a good night out, man." The next lad we got on board was really amenable and really lovely lad, got on with everybody great, a lad called Conrad Lant, who now, with hindsight, has gone on to be Kronos of Venom.
The stories are hilarious. It was always, "Need records? Oh yes, yes. Let me put you through to our A&R department." They thought it was this empire. But this, you know, it's a record company. No, it wasn't. It was the backstage rooms of an old theatre that was a bingo hall downstairs. It was basically Dave, and they had this guy Russ, who was a young kid acting as A&R, and they had a secretary, and they had an engineer or an in-house producer, Keith Nichol, at one point. Before then, it was Mickey Sweeney was the engineer, and Steve Thompson would do a lot of the production stuff.
Impulse Studios was built into the wings of what was once a Brewer Theatre. When I got there, when it was a studio, it was Johnny's Bingo. So you'd go up a flight of stairs, and you'd come to the reception. Up another flight of stairs, and you'd come to another area where we'd store the tapes, and then up another flight of stairs. You're with me on the stairs. We're talking about many, many flights of stairs. Concrete stairs. You got to the very top. I don't know why the studio was put at the top, because that was the bane of roadies' lives. If you had no roadies, you'd have to carry all your kit up the stairs.
The studio had a 16-track machine, 8 or 9 foot high, with these huge modules for each track, 2-inch tape machine, and the head looked as if it had been put on a grinder. And this was the original machine from Trident in London, where they'd done Ziggy Stardust, was done on that machine, which was kind of cool. Well, they had that, they had the board, they had a reverb unit, and they had an echo unit, and that was it.
John Roach had opted not to record at Impulse and instead recorded with his band Mithra at Guardian Studios, a Colliery House-cum-studio run by Terry Gavigan in Pity Me in Durham.
Impulse Studio stank. There was old discarded mattresses in a room which were used as like soundproofing and stuff like that. And it was all smell of musty, damp, old carpet.
There was no aircon whatsoever, so it was just a hot, sweaty, horrible, place, stinky. As you imagine, all this heavy metal band and other people in there and everything, you know. But very productive, because it did have a history. There's lots of bands being in there, you know. You could smell the music in there that's been created type thing, and that helped.
I remember one drummer in a band locally came in and he said, a recording studio in Wall's End? You must be kidding. I suppose it was a little bit unusual because the area is industry, engineering, shipbuilding, the end of coal mining. So it was really kind of an industrial area rather than an artistic area. So we're plonked in the middle of all that lot, developing art. So from then, the people used the studio to record all sorts of things. I mean, we did folk music, the odd band as they were forming, you know, these guys who were probably working in the shipbuilding or at Parsons or somewhere like that in the area, couldn't wait to get out on a Friday afternoon and pick up a guitar.
David Wood had already created a number of labels over the years to release material recorded at Impulse. Woodwink was a jazz label, with signings like the Newcastle Big Band, of which Wall's End's most famous export, Sting, was the bass player. Sting was a long-time friend of David Wood, and on occasion had been Wood's milkman. He continued to record with his next popular band, The Last Exit. There was Picador Records and Rubber Records, a folk label working with a variety of Northeast contemporary and trad folk artists, Lindisfarne, Tony Capstick and Mike Harding, who would later go on to have a hit with Rochdale Cowboy. The studio had famously recorded a very successful album with The Little Waster, a very old-school Geordie comedian Bobby Thompson, which according to Ian Ravendale and Sounds, had shifted a quarter of a million smackers worth of product. Neat Records was David's next venture. The idea of creating a sister label, Tidy, had thankfully been flouted. Neat was founded in 1979, just as the new wave of British heavy metal came into being. And music journalists who had been obsessed with punk were now catching on to the enormous number of rock and metal bands who had all been plugging away in the background. And a lot of these could really play. Neat started life with no direction and no ground rules. It would be what it would be, and no doubt had it floundered, Wood would just have wrapped it up and launched his next venture. But things didn't quite turn out like that. The label's first two singles were commercially unsuccessful. Neato 1, Motorways, All I Wanna Be Is Your Romeo, failed to excite the record-buying public. And Neato 2, One and Only Girl, sung by a 9-year-old Janie McKenzie and written by in-house producer Steve Thompson, was largely just sold at her gigs. It was Neato 3, and four good-looking lads from Whitley Bay, Jess, Rob, Rocky and Brian, in their oddly titled outfit Tigers of Pantang, that would put Neat Records on the path to the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame.
I'm sat in Rocky's lounge, and we're throwing around ideas for this band that we had. All sorts of names were bandied about. The one that I chucked in the pot that I thought was the best one that I thought of was Achilles Heel. And Rocky said, what about Tigers of Pantang? Where on earth have you got that from? And he said, well, you know, I read fantasy science fiction books. One of my favourite authors is Michael Moorcock. But I'm reading a book called Stormbringer. And in the storyline of the book is this emperor, where he lives, his principality, is guarded by attack tigers, and they sit on the cliffs of Pantang. So he said, I just sort of put it all together, Tigers of Pantang.
Former lead singer Jess Cox and guitarist Rob Weir can't seem to agree on how the band got started. So I let them both have their turn.
Rob Weir came over to the table. I was sitting there and said, I understand you're a singer. And I was like, well, sort of, yeah. Play guitar and sing in a band called Willie Nutty World. He says, yeah, I know. He says, but we just want a singer. I said, well, not really. I am, but I'm not a front. I can do, I suppose. He says, well, go on then. He says, you look good, so you might as well be a singer. All right then. I'll be a singer then, but I'd rather play guitar. But anyway, go on then. I said, what music, kind of music do you do? And he went like, Ted Nugent, Motorhead, and I'm like, UFO. And he says, we haven't got any songs to tell you the truth. We're just starting up. You know, there's a guy called Rocky, a guy called Brian, they live locally. We're just trying to get four people together. We know about you. We want you to be the fourth member with us.
We had two applicants. One was Jess Cox, and one, I can't remember the lad's name. He looked very much like John Lennon. Jess was a lot more suitable. Jess had his own PA, which this other lad didn't, which was a big bonus in those days, because we just had our own personal equipment. We didn't own a PA. So it was a case of, you've got the job, because you've got a PA.
The band was taken on by Tom Noble as their manager, and had signed up with Birchall's agency. They were playing the working men's clubs and had secured a Wednesday night residency at Mingles. They'd saved up all of their cash and recorded a 3-track demo at Impulse under the cover of David Wood's all-comers policy.
There's a girl worked in Mingles, which was a nightclub in Whitley Bay, well, a nightclub, a little bar, and we knew she fancied Rob, so we sent him in to chat her up to get her to get the manager to give us a residency. So they had a biker's night, and he put us on there every Saturday night as a resident band, playing heavy metal covers for the bikers. I was at his house one day and we saw the Sounds magazine. He said, oh, these people sound like you, these kids here. And he gave us this Sounds paper, which was the only paper you got any information from at the time. And we saw this band called Def Leppard. And I remember thinking, what the hell is a Def Leppard? Stupid name. Says me with the Tiger's Pan time. But anyway, they sent the spread and I read it and I thought, yeah, it did sound like us actually. Just four young lads, you know, work class lads, doing one demo, same as us. Tom said, I'll send them your demo because we just done a demo. Because with the money we got from playing Mingles, we'd start to write our own songs as well. We had like three songs or something. And we went into Impulse Studios in Mall's End and recorded this demo. Found out who wrote the article. It's a guy called Jeff Barton. So we sent it to him. And then lo and behold, the next week, there's a big pullout in there called The New Wave of British Heavy Metal.
We played Whitley Bay High School, an after-school event in the gymnasium. And there were two lads there who had heard of us, and they'd asked their dad if he would come along and have a look and have a listen because they thought we were really good. And their dad owned a recording studio, and that was Impulse Recording Studio in Wall's End. And he came along, and after the show, Dave and Tom got talking, and then the next thing that we know is that we've been invited into the studio to record some of our original songs.
Dave said, right, now, here's the third one. I want you to do this. There's this band. All right, that was my job. So, yeah, right, let's book some time in. And then they came, and I said, let's just get warmed up, go through a few numbers. And they played a few songs, and my jaw dropped. I thought this went out of fashion ages ago. The Tigers were raw. So, right, what do you do with this? So I left it there, and a few weeks later, Dave said to me, have you mixed those tracks yet? I said, no, Dave, they're awful. He says, they're still making waves out there. I want this record out. Get in there and fix it. So we went in and we did some reamping. We'd take the guitar track and feed it back through into an amplifier and record that. So it got bigger. And all I could think to do, I said to Mickey Sweeney, let's just exaggerate the raw energy and just get it down. And that's what we did.
Need all three. Don't Touch Me There. It was officially released in December 1979, and it was resplendent in its orangey yellow, tiger adorned titleless cover and 2-track flip side. The neat pressing reportedly shifted about 7,000 copies. Now, MCA Records had caught wind of the Tigers and had approached David Wood, who arranged a deal with the hope of being a feeder to a major label. The intention was that Neat would discover bands, test the water with a single or two, and then they'd progress to MCA to be nurtured, and they could break them into the big time.
We played at Sunderland Boilermakers Club, which was for shipwrights and stuff, working men, you know, and five major labels had flown up. It was a Friday night as well, unheard of. And it was the heads of the labels as well. I didn't even know what was going on. I didn't even really care. Nobody cared, to tell you the truth, because I didn't know anything about nothing. It wasn't like, oh, this is all big break or something. I remember being more interested in this girl and being cheesed off because I was dragged in to speak to them. And as introduced to them, MCA, Virgin, EMI, big labels. And then a couple of weeks later, the manager guy, Tom Noble, Carnival called us into the pub and said, oh, they want to sign you. What's that mean? You get your rent paid and £6 a week. And we're like, oh, do that then. Honestly, we didn't know anything or nothing. And then within weeks, we were on a tour. We went off with Magnum. First date in Cardiff. Might as well be in the moon. Do? What do you eat? I don't know. We bought 20 loaves and a tin of beans. But nothing else. At least we look at beans on toast. We won't starve. We drove down to Cardiff, set the beans and toast up going, and we were having that. Magnum walked through. I mean, we were lifting cars from Birmingham. We go, oh, beans on toast. We love beans on toast. So we all sat down. We all had beans on toast.
After the Tigers' Don't Touch Me There came South Shields' Fist with name, rank and serial number, and Middlesbrough's White Spirit with Back to the Grind, which were both released in the first half of 1980. Both bands snapped up by MCA as part of the feeder deal. Sounds Music Paper picked up on it, and the local music journalist Ian Ravendale highlighted what was going on in Are You Ready for the Northeast New Wave of British Heavy Metal? Published in May 1980, one of the many articles that he'd write about the local rock and metal scene.
I'd done stuff about the individual bands who were starting to get signed to Neat Records, which was being produced out of Impulse Studios in Wall's End. So I'd worked my way through those, and Jeff had probably said, well, how about a big article rather than just a 200-word review? So I ended up doing this 4,000 or 5,000-word article. I covered all of the major Northeast rock bands. Some of the bands were obvious. There was no point in writing about the Tigers because we'd done that. But, hey, there's these guys, Raven. Well, they're something different. So write about them. Yeah, White Spirit, they're a little bit older. One of them might be 27, you know, dear me. So I wrote about them. And they were essentially a professional band, and they were living off what they got from working. They weren't on the dole. They were actually full-time musicians. And they were certainly musically the best out of the Northeast bands. Fist were another one who were very, very good as well.
MCA was a bit, we sort of went in with both feet then. We should have maybe hung on and saw if we could get something a little bit better. I think MCA, because of the new wave of British heavy metal, Iron Maiden had come through. MCA decided they wanted to basically sign anybody who they thought was new wave of British heavy metal. They didn't really understand, I think, what was involved. So they signed a few bands, obviously, alongside myself. Basically, I think they believed that they just had to record an album, chuck it out without any real marketing or anything, and just it was going to be a success. And unfortunately, the production on the album was tragic. We didn't like it at all. Derek Lawrence was the producer, who was very good, produced Wishbone Ash, etc. But he wasn't really heavy metal type producer. He didn't make Fist sound like Fist. It sounded great in the studio through gigantic speakers, but when you put it on smaller speakers, which is what everybody tends to use domestically, obviously it didn't have that same power. Everywhere we went, name, rank and serial number, it's still infamously widely regarded as one of the best songs of the new wave of British heavy metal. A few years ago, playing in Germany and playing on the continent, guys in the audience who are like 25, they actually knew the words to name, rank and serial number and the chorus line and everything, which absolutely amazed me because I haven't got a clue what it is. There was a really good positive vibe about the band and about the business. I mean, we did a big tour with UFO, which was very good. We did 43 nights, I think, split over two separate sections. I think we needed to push it a bit further than what we actually did at the time. We just thought it was automatically going to happen, and it didn't. Simple as.
Sadly, the MCA deal didn't work out for Fist and White Spirit. Both bands recorded one album apiece before they were dropped. From the outside, it looked like MCA desperately wanted some metal acts on their roster to capitalise on a growing market, but didn't know what to do with them when they had them. So it was back to the drawing board for Neat.
They weren't selling the numbers that they wanted, so that deal died a bit of a death. But I thought, well, we can't really just leave it at that because we quite like this music. So we decided to put things out ourselves independently, and I found a good independent distributor and worked to develop that. And it kind of took off slowly, but we got there and got some interest.
Next up for Neat was Raven. Like myself, Barbarians from Benwell, brothers John and Mark Gallagher and their mustachioed drummer, Rob Hunter.
Played our first show at our school in December 1975, but formed the band in 74 before we could really play. There was three of us, the guy down the street, Paul Bowden, played guitar as well. And we went through 1,000 drummers and eventually Paul left. And we got a guy in called Rob Hunter at the tail end of 79 and went as a three-piece and boom, everything happened from there on out. We'd played before with a band called the Tigers of Pantan. And they were in the same dressing room. And my brother points at me and goes, "Look at her arse." And it turns around, it was one of the guys. You know, they were very much image conscious, where we were not so much image conscious. But we remember them, and the manager and the guys in the band came to see us play a show at Bambra's, which is down on the Big Market. And Tom Noble came up afterwards and said, "Loved the show. How would you guys like to do a single?" "Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it."
So into Impulse they went and recorded a 3-track demo of Don't Need Your Money, Wiped Out and Let It Rip, with the speedy rhythmic Don't Need Your Money taking the A side, the equally exciting trip Wiped Out on the B side. The guys had earned the title of athletic rock. The music was a workout in itself. It was super fast and energetic. There'd been nothing quite like it before, and people couldn't get enough.
Ozzy heard John Peel play our single and said, "I want those guys to play with me." And they got in touch, and we did 4 shows with a Blizzard of Oz lineup.
And so David Wood took the plunge and greenlit a full album release.
Dave said, "Well, you need to meet the guys, and they've got a show at Mingles." Now, Mingles was a rock venue in Whitley Bay that was notorious for its dress policy. If you weren't scruffy enough, they wouldn't let you in. It was a funny venue because it was long and narrow. So I was stood in front against the wall. I'm only about, I'd say, 20 feet away from the band, and they're up there doing their thing. And I don't know if we'd been introduced or nothing, but they knew who I was. And in the middle of a song, John Gallagher pointed his bass guitar towards me, like a javelin, and was still playing it. And so this was strange. And then he leapt off the stage, which was only 6 inches high, and hurtled towards me with the headstock of this bass coming straight towards my head. And he stopped half an inch from my throat. And I didn't flinch because I knew it was a test. I could tell what was coming. And then this tiny, imperceptible smile came over. And I smiled back ever so slightly, "Please don't kill me," you know. And off we went. With the way they were, I said to Dave, "I'm going to do this album, and I think it'll be great, but I need to do it in short sessions of 3 days on, 3 days off, just like the Steelworks, 3 on, 3 off. Because I said, I can't be in the studio with those guys for 2 months non-stop, I'll go crazy. The energy, they were just crazy, over the top, and I thought it would wear me out. So we did 3 day sessions and then take a break. That's how we did the album. There was one particular instance where Mark was trying to get a guitar solo overdub and it wasn't quite there. We'd had a few takes, so I just pushed the talkback button and I said, "Mark, I'm going to give you one more take, and if you don't get it, I'm going to come in there and do it myself, you wussy." And then I give the nod to Mickey and he went in to record, and Mark went berserk, throwing himself against the wall, smashing his guitar off the walls, making a horrendous racket, and we took it. The sessions were wild. At one point in time, I had to start the gaffer tape, the headphones to their heads, because they were leaping all over the place, and the headphones were shooting off. The story from that album that has stood the test of time and still gets told is the coffee cup story. And it came to the point where we were doing Rock Until You Drop. And for some reason, that suggested to me, it starts with a bass drum. Bum, 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 ba ba da bum. It suggests a marching. And it's Rock Until You Drop, a sense of an army. So I said to the guys, and they talk about some of the ideas that I've told them that didn't work out. But they would have a go at every suggestion, which is great. And for this, I said, we should have a marching sound at the beginning. Now, the top level of Impulse, and it's all concrete flooring, where the stairs are obviously carpets in the studio and the control room,
But next door to the control room were the toilets, which had a concrete floor. They weren't particularly salubrious, quite rough and ready. And I said we could march on in there. So again, I asked Mickey to take two of his very expensive Neumann microphones and place them in the, because we wanted stereo and everything, obviously, and assembled as many people. So Conrad would have been in there, Conrad Lant, otherwise known as Kronos. And we were stamping on the floor. And the sound we were getting was like pit pat. It's just nowhere near. And we double tracked it. It still didn't have that. I could hear in my head what an army sounds like, and it didn't sound like that. So I thought, oh, let's take a break. And I went down to the next level, where the green room is, where we have a coffee dispenser. And I had a coffee and I was thinking about how can we do this. And I thought if we had some gravel, you know, but you would need a ton of gravel. And it was midnight, so I couldn't do that. And I thought, I'm just going to have to leave this. And I was having this cup of coffee in one of those typical plastic coffee cups. And as I'd finished it, I scrunched it up to throw it in the bin and went, and I thought, eureka moment, that's the sound. So I went into the stores room and I got a whole load of coffee cups. And I took them up and threw them on the floor in the loos and sent the guys through. And it had that sound, crunch, 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 crunch. And we faded it in as it comes in. But we only had four or five guys, the band, plus Conrad, and anybody else was there. It might have been just the four of them. And we double-tracked it and triple-tracked it to get a bigger sound. And by the time we double and triple-tracked, it still wasn't big enough to squash the coffee cups flat. So I went back down and got some more. And I made that trip several times till I finally went through 3,000 coffee cups. We used the whole supply, but it sounded great. And the next morning, Dave Wood said to me, what's happened to the coffee cups? Because now they were not in the storeroom, they were in black bin liners, 3,000. I said, we had to use it to get the sound we wanted for that track. He said, think of the cost. I said, oh, you're kidding, man, you should hear the track. And he was just concerned about the cost of all these coffee cups. And we also got a complaint from Johnny's Bingo because they could see the shadows. There was a shaft went right down to the building and they could see the shadows of these guys marching in the loos and the horrendous noise of this coffee cup thing. Clearly, you've got two microphones, two very expensive Neumann microphones in the loos. What are you going to do? John says, I need to go take a dump. I said, oh, let's get your arse mic'd up and we'll see who had come. And again, this is from the Beatles era, because what we do, we recorded John taking a dump in stereo and then reversed the tape and we put that on the album somewhere. Now, never mind searching for your satanic messages, but get the Rock Until You Drop album and see if you can find the reverse shit somewhere embedded in one of the tracks.
After testing the market with Lead Weight, originally a cassette-only sampler featuring B-side session leftovers, Raven's Rock Until You Drop became the label's first vinyl release in May of 1981. Writing in Sounds, Jeff Barton stated it was the best LP to emerge out of the new wave of British heavy metal since Saxon's Wheels of Steel. Rare praise indeed. And 1981 was a stellar year for Neat. More signings followed with a further seven singles being added to the catalogue. Black Ice by Aragorn, In League with Satan by Venom, Bitches Sin Always Ready for Love, Buried Alive by Blitzkrieg, a second single Hard Ride from Raven, Raw Deal's Lone Wolf, and the double A-side Rock Out and All Systems Go by Steel. Meanwhile, it would be remiss not to mention Metal Minded Records, David Wood's next label after Neat, established to release records for the more progressive rock bands. But after just two singles, Lady by Axis and Badger's Silver Woman, Metal Minded was wound up and integrated with Neat itself. Had they not split up, the second Axis 7-inch You Got It would have been Neat 13, as it was Venom naturally, bagged that particular catalogue number for their second single, Bloodlust. Before the year was out, Venom's Welcome to Hell was unleashed, in complete contrast to the overly protracted sessions that spawned Raven's LP. Venom's debut was bashed out in a matter of days. Their jaw-dropping single In League with Satan had left no doubt that an LP release would not be vinyl wasted. So their next demo session was turned into an album, which was apparently put to tape in 3 days. Its arrival in the record shop racks gave Neat its third 5 out of 5 review in Sounds, with Jeff Barton oozing, "This album brings new meaning to the word cataclysmic and is possibly the heaviest record ever allowed into shops for public consumption." But more on Venom later, for it seemed like Neat Records had arrived.